Hey yo, and here we go. Welcome to another episode of We Talk Music. I am Mr. Brett Podcast, the Chief Defender of the Faith. And I am joined by my co-host, the crown prince of charisma.
Nah, I've dropped. I'm no longer the crown. I'm now. I'd like to think of myself as the futurist. Anyways, doesn't matter. I thought you were the king of the casters. All this is great, Mr. Brett Podcast, but really, let's get to who's important, and it's not us.
That is true. We are not the important ones here. We are joined by an extra special guest. We have John Gallagher from Raven. John, how are you doing?
I am doing fine, gentlemen. It's good to be here.
Well, we are happy to have you on the show to talk about Raven's new live album, Screaming Murder, Death from Above, live in Aalborg. I'm sure I'm screwing up Aalborg in some way. But
Aalborg.
Well, like I've been saying at the shows when I've been talking about it, it may sound like a Danish testicular disease, but it's actually a city. So there you go.
It's actually the city I was born in, so, you know.
I find that difficult to believe, but if that's true, fair enough.
It's true. It's the city where most of my family is. I mean, we're over here in Canada where we settled, but yes, that's where my roots are, is Aalborg.
Well, there you go.
There we go. That doesn't mean I still agree about the thing.
No shit about it, but you know what? It's a small world.
No, it absolutely is. Like I say, I still agree with the testicular thing. I mean,
all right. Well, so John, I read in the press release that you guys actually had no idea that this was being recorded when you did it.
Nope, not a clue. What had happened was with the magic of technology. Now the soundboards quite often have a feed where you can plug in a computer and you can put in a memory stick or whatever. And the guy at the end of the show just handed this thing to Mike and says, "Here, check this out. I recorded the show," and he forgot about it. And we got one or two other recordings. We're talking about, hey, maybe we could put out a live thing of some description, because there's been some issues with the recording of the new studio album, which is, you know, it's like freaking War and Peace at this point. It's dragging on, just kind of problems. And he said, "I've got this memory stick, let me check it out." And then he got back, he says, "You won't believe it, it's like really great." I'm like, "Really?" And there was a couple of technical issues, the biggest one of which was I'd broke a string at the beginning of Hell Patrol, kept on singing because I have my trusty headset mic, but there was like a 5-second gap, so we just did a quick cut and paste to fill that hole. But that was it. Everything else was warts and all, sounded great, so we just said bugger it, and what you hear is what you get. And we just loved it because it's got so much energy, and it's a great introduction to the band as we are right now in 2018, even though that was November 2017, but it gives you a good clue of where we are and where we're going with the next record, you know.
Yeah, it was recorded in 2017. It is now 2018. It'll be released in 2019. So we're doing pretty good.
Like I say, you can see, and that was all working relatively quickly. And you get the studio album, and it's like trials and tribulations. And none of these things happen quickly. But we're very happy we got it, and they did a really great job putting the cover together. It's like the covers when you grew up. There was a live album, you wanted to have all the cool photographs and some good information. It's there. It's a great package.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely, it sounds like you've had a wild and crazy time. How important is it to you to capture that real Raven live?
It's incredibly important. It really is. I mean, I had an argument with somebody actually who was reviewing it, And he wasn't too happy with the sound. I'm like, well, what kind of sound do you want? Do you want it like most of the live albums that come out now, which are actually recorded in the studio, and maybe they add some fake crowd on it? And if you went to the show, this is what it sounds like. If you don't believe me, pull up YouTube. There's thousands of videos of us playing live. This is what we sound like. I'm completely unapologetic about that. And, you know, we're a rock and roll band. We go out there. We're noisy. We make mistakes occasionally. But at the same time, you get those times where it's like capturing lightning in a bottle, and it's like a one-off. And there's a lot of instances of that in that particular show, which just blew us away. I think the version of Hell Patrol is like probably the best one I've heard. It's great. So look, we're very happy with it. It's very important to capture that, you know, the on the edge of chaos, on the edge of falling apart, because that's where the excitement is. There's no excitement in, you know, you might as well all put on tuxedos and sit down at a chair and have your sheet music in front of you. That's not what we're about.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have been going at this for so long now, and it's so amazing. How do you keep yourselves in good enough shape to keep going?
Well, I mean, we stay fit. We live relatively healthy. My voice is as good as it ever was, if not better. I don't drink. Really, I never smoked. I never did any funny stuff. I tried to get sleep at night, you know, those kind of things. It makes a difference. I see other people of my age painfully floundering their way through a set, and, you know, that's kind of embarrassing. We, you know, pride ourselves on being able to deliver as well as we ever have, if not better. And I feel we still do. So, and we still enjoy it. We enjoy it more now than ever because we appreciate it more now than we did when we were in our 20s. You know, you're young, naive. You just want to get up and jump around and have a good time. Now we appreciate what that means.
How, so when you chose the set list for this, I know that you have a lot of fresh songs that you haven't played live in a long time. So talk about how you go about choosing a set list, like from back then, and how you would also choose a set list now.
Well, it's odd. I mean, we have a very extensive back catalogue, and we have, you know, Mike Heller, our drummer, joined us last year after our, you know, drummer for many, many years, Joe Hasselbander, had a heart attack and bowed out. Basically because of that and the fact he really didn't want to be on the road anymore. So it's kind of worked out great for everybody. We have this influx of energy from Mike, who's from a totally different generation and headspace. So we each bring something. We're bringing new stuff to him. He's bringing a new approach to us. And it's really forging a renaissance for us, as it were. We go out there, and of course, you know, he doesn't know all the songs, so, you know, we kind of are learning on the job. We've still never had an official rehearsal. we've probably done 200 gigs with Mike at this point. We've never had an official rehearsal. The first gig he did with us, when Joe had the heart attack, 2 days later we had a string of dates, and we were like, oh my god. And a friend of ours, Tom Hazard, pulled a couple of guys together. I had this guy from Chicago who filled in the first date. And we booked rehearsal because we'd never played in 6 months. So that helped for that. The next 3 gigs was with Mike. And we talked for half an hour. And we went out and he played a full set. And it was really odd because we're looking at each other like, why is he playing it like this? Why is he playing it like that? After 30 years that you've alter your arrangements and playing style, it changes. He was playing it from what he heard on the records, and it was like exact. We're like, no, loosen up a bit, you know, be a bit more creative, play faster here. Oh, really? Oh, good. And we just said, yeah, just go crazy, just do, yeah, go nuts. Which, from the the gig he was playing before was very regimented and very, very, you know, machine-like. So to have the ability to go out and improvise and go crazy, he just loved that. And that's what we're about. You know, our little fills, our solos, they're never the same from night to night. There's a large bit of improvisation and spontaneity, which is what makes it fun. You know, if you want to play the same notes every night, it would get very, very boring. This way we can, you know, you have a framework and you challenge yourself here and there to try and do something different. And we play off each other. You know, I'll hear Mike do a fill and turn around and be dying laughing, and he's got a big smile on his face because he just tried to pull off the most ridiculous fill on earth and got away with it, or didn't, as the case may be. And, you know, we'll do the same thing. I'll play off what Mark's doing. We usually have this little jam part and break the chain where we'll, you know, stretch out. For this particular album and set, we were opening for Udo Dirkschneider over in Europe, our old friend who used to be the singer with Accept, who was actually doing an Accept set. And we had an hour set. So it's like, well, we're playing bigger audiences, you know, so we're going to be delving into a lot of the older stuff, but we'll put a few new ones in as well. And that's basically what we were playing. You try to tick a large number of boxes. When you're playing a headline set, you can get to stretch out a little more, bring in a few more old chestnuts. But even on this, we were playing songs that we'd never played in many years because we figured, well, there's going to be people coming who know us. Let's throw them a bone too, give them something different, you know. So it hung together. It was a good set, and it's tougher when you're playing a set like that to start messing around with it because there's time constraints. And if you take, you know, they're so tight, you finish the set and, you know, it's like, get off. You've literally got 5 minutes to get all the equipment off stage and clear it so they can do their last-minute checks and then do their show, you know. So you definitely plan it out and like, okay, we're going to finish. It'll be an hour on the nose. Or in our case, we give ourselves 3 or 4 minutes so there's enough time to throw equipment around and make a noise at the end.
Yeah, I guess we as fans often don't think about that kind of thing. How well planned, down to the minute, down to the second almost, that the opening sets have to be. Sometimes it feels like, especially in the early days of the 80s when you're, you know, watching music and concerts, and it's just like, oh yeah, no problem. So the headliner is going to go on, and it might be 45 minutes or an hour after the opener went on. And things have changed for the better, I think, now in a lot of cases.
Yeah, people usually don't realize that you know, sets of, you know, like a show's usually timed. You know, the main band's going to play at 9 o'clock, and you know, the hall has to close at a certain time. And those times are usually more important when it's a weekday because they want to do a show and they don't want people missing their last buses, especially in Europe with public transport and stuff, you know. So if the opening band drags ass and takes too long, then it screws everything up. So it's very much a professionalism thing, and you pride yourselves on being able to get on and get off and do your thing. It's, you know, you're there to do a job. You're in there to kick the ass of the audience and get them going. And we certainly did that on that tour. We just did a run with Saxon, which was a lot of fun as well. Did the European dates, everything but the UK dates, which we played some shows earlier there. But that was awesome as well. A lot of fun.
When you're working with a younger band, maybe that you're not as familiar with, and they're opening for you, do you kind of give them any advice about, you know, opening or on stage, or how do you kind of approach it? I mean, a lot of younger bands out there obviously have kind of look up to you.
Yeah, I mean, you'd certainly try to do that. There's always a little teething period when a band comes on. You're like, you know, okay, how's this going to run? And you first ascertain whether they're going to be normal people or if they're going to be a little strange or if they're going to be jerks. Because there's not many there's not many jerks out there, but if you're going to find some jerks, it's, you know, usually going to be the younger variety, because you've got to give them the benefit of the doubt that they don't know this stuff. So you fill them in, you let them know what you expect, and more often than not, it's like, oh, I really appreciate you telling me this. Or, you know, we'll say, hey, you know, time's really tight tonight. You can use my bass rig. Wow, that's really cool of you. Thank you very much. You know, I don't mind. We'll do what's necessary to make the show work. We want our opening band to go out there and, you know, play, if not a full set, at least a fair set. And, you know, there's no diluting their performance as far as, like, you know, you get two lights and we're not going to turn the subs on the PA, which a lot of bands will do. They'll really try to neuter the opening band, which to me makes no sense whatsoever. You know, if people are coming to see a show, why would you, you know, basically try to sabotage your opening act? That's just, you know, that kind of thing really, really annoys us, because it's happened to us in the past. So we always would say that if, you know, we ever got in the position where the tables were turned with that, we would try to give the opening band a fair shake, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about that, because I know that we've gone to concerts that the opening act hasn't been very good, but you would like to think that it wasn't very good based on, you know, their merits, so to speak, as opposed to
exactly rather than else, like, yeah. Wow, these guys could have, yeah, they could have been good, but the sound was dreadful, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And when you're
it doesn't happen too often, but I know, because I've been on the receiving end of it, it does happen.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you're going to a show, you want to be able to enjoy the whole show. And there's no question that a great opening act, as long as, you know, especially when the headliner's great too, then you've gotten an awesome package, because that opening act is doing that.
And that's the whole idea. Otherwise, why bother having an opening act? If you're going to put a band on that either is totally does not fit with the main band, you know, and we've seen packages like that as well, especially when I was a kid in England, you'd see it was obvious what they would call the buy on. I mean, and that's another factor that people don't realize. Like, oh man, why did they have this band on? Well, they have this band on because they may suck, but they had a lot of money and they were willing to pay the band $20,000 so they could open up for them. And there was a time, like I said, as a kid in England, you'd see the same two or three bands opening every show, because they had at the time a bottomless well of money, and they were just, you know, we want to open for such and such. And like, oh my God, here you go again. And you'll see it these days. There's a lot of bands where, you know, maybe one of the members of the band has a kid who's got a band now, and they're going to open for the band on every tour. You know, that kind of thing happens. Saying no names, but, you know.
I remember reading about. You don't have to say who names.
You can figure that one out for yourself, you know. And again, yeah, hey, fair enough. You know, if you've got that position and you want to do nepotism, that great, go. But after a while, if it's the same band going round and round, it gets a bit annoying. I remember years ago seeing Blue Oyster Cult, and the opening band was a band called Japan. I don't know if you remember them. They were kind of very glammy. Lots of makeup and teased out hair and suits. They were kind of Roxy Music-esque. They were actually very good at what they did. But you put them in the north of England opening for Blue Oyster Cult. I remember they finished their first song and there was absolute silence. And one kid stood up and screamed at the top of his voice, F off. Ouch.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Cruel. And this was our education. You would see when an opening band and you were very interested, it's like, how are they going to handle? Because the northern audiences were very harsh, but fair. If you were good, they'd lap it up. They'd love it. But if they were bad, they'd tear you to pieces. So you'd see this and go, okay, you know, is this band doing good? Is this band bombing? And why? and you'd learn from that, you know.
Well, yeah. And you're talking about one of the most passionate fan bases in the world with this type of music, right? I mean, you can't mess with them. They know what they want.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, I mean, in the way where I am right now, Newcastle, England, as a kid there was two real religions. One was football, or what you call soccer, and the other was music. And that was church. You'd go there and the band would come on, the lights would go down. It was a seated venue, the City Hall. The lights would go down and there would be an insane rush to fight the bouncers to push so you could stand at the front rather than stand at your seat. It was mayhem. A lot of fun. No one ever got hurt, but a lot of fun.
That's always the important thing, because I mean, it's terrible when people wind up getting hurt at the shows, but there's no question that I think the sense of the energy from a show like this, from like a real metal show, there's really nothing like it.
No, of course not. That's what it's all about. And of course, this was pre mosh pits and stage diving and all that nonsense, which we always felt detracted from what was going on. It's like, you guys need to start a rugby league or go play American football or something, you know, or do some oil yourselves up and do some naked wrestling, you know, have fun. Go on.
Well, it becomes like the audiences. They're there not for the band. They're there to entertain themselves.
I remember very clearly a kid I used to know. Oh, man, went to see Pantera last week, man. Oh, yeah, how was the show? It was awesome. There was this huge dude, man. He wouldn't go down in the pit, and like we jumped on him, and he did. I'm like, what about the band? What were they playing? I don't know. So it was, they might as well have brought a boombox and been beating each other up in the back lane, you know? It's ridiculous. So it does detract a little bit. I mean, I understand, you know, the energy and, you know, whipping the fans up and getting it going and all that stuff. It's fun. But at a certain point, it's like, who cares who the band is? And you've seen it too. And you see these festivals and there'll be some ridiculous college band and the crowd's slam dancing and stage diving. And they might, they'll basically stage dive into a watered down Dave Matthews or something, you know. Yeah, right. How many? What kind of drugs are you on this week?
So, how has your audience changed over, you know, over the years that you've been playing?
Well, it's broadened, which is what's really awesome. And we started noticing this pretty much right about the time Mark was getting over his accident. A quick sidebar: Mark had a terrible accident in 2001 and nearly died, and nearly had his legs cut off and nearly never walked again, and proved all the doctors wrong, but it took about 4 years to get over it. And by that time we were starting to do festivals and starting to get accolades from what you were saying before, younger bands going, oh man, we're really influenced by you, and starting to hear this stuff which we'd never really heard before. And you'd start seeing the audiences that'd be like two and three generations getting to play other countries. I would go to South America and play in Brazil, and there's like nobody in the hall over 25. I was like, wow, really weird. And then we play the States, and you've got people bringing their kids. And it's a real mixture, and you're seeing a younger generation who are, you know, not too impressed with a lot of today's music, and they want to get into the classic bands. And, you know, we appear to be one of the bands they want to listen to, which is a lot of fun. That's great.
So I'm interested because you and Mark have been playing together for so long, I know there's so many other bands out there, Oasis, the Kinks, and stuff that have had brothers that maybe don't get along so well. What's kind of the secret to your relationship?
Oh, we we used to fight before we started playing, and then I always joked about we started just taking it out on the guitars. We have a lot of bashed up and dented guitars at this point. But no, it's definitely a plus rather than a minus. We can have a disagreement or an argument, and 5 minutes later it's forgotten and we just move on the way it's supposed to be, you know, rather than the usual strange dynamic in bands where it's like some sort of twisted marriage. Usually nothing's brought out into the open and stuff festers, and all of a sudden somebody explodes and loses their temper. And, you know, it's very dysfunctional. So this reduces the dysfunction at least by one person, you know.
Have you ever been in that situation where you're on tour with a band and you know they're not getting along? Maybe your dressing room is next to their dressing room and you can hear it and that type of thing. Is it really a strange dynamic for you?
Oh, yeah. But it happens in every band. And then any band that says that they're not doing it is either very lucky or they're just lying about it. We've been through it. It's definitely happened. And it's not a fun place to be, because that takes away, you know, the whole deal of being in a band and playing the music. It's basically that hour or hour and a half you're on stage, and everything else is pretty much a pain in the neck. Yeah, I was working, doing some teaching in a school of rock, and it was interesting when they were taking the kids and they say, okay, we're going to, you know, there's going to be three bands here, and it's you, and you. Go off and discuss what you're going to play and how you're going to play it. And, you know, putting them in at the ground level and just watching how people interact with each other. Yeah, because it is strange. Most, you know, it's like you find in life, most people are cool, but everyone's a little weird in their own way. And this is like a magnifying glass on that. It really can bring out the best and the worst in people.
Yeah. So is teaching something that you do other than playing in Raven?
I'm not doing it currently, but I've done it off and on for like the last 10 years or so, yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's great because you re-examine your own playing, and, you know, when someone says, you know, when you're doing that, how are you doing that? And a lot of your playing's instinctual, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm putting my thumb under the strings here to mute a couple of strings. Well, most people don't do it that way. Oh, never thought of that. Or you're muting with your right hand, or there's a particular finger style pattern you're using, or technique. And so that's when that's pointed out, that's interesting. And you will definitely learn from teaching. I learned so many cool things from teaching people. So it was, you know, a give and take thing, definitely. It's a lot of fun. And it's good to be able to just give back a bit, you know. I've learned a lot of stuff, and I teach kids that, you know, if you're going to go and play a show, don't put your cord straight in the guitar. Put it around the strap so when you stand on it, you don't stand there like an idiot when you pull out the jack and you make your big solo face and it goes dink, you know.
That's great.
We've all seen those videos where the guy's trying to throw the guitars around their body and the guitar comes off and smashes into the wall or something. It's like, yeah, don't do that. Or if you're going to do that, make sure it doesn't come off.
Yeah, I know. There's so many things that you just don't think about. It's fantastic. And you guys know all of them.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I've done that, and done that on the internet when people have talked about things on some of these bass things and all that. I'm like, yeah, I put my guitar straps on permanently with 3-inch screws so they'll never come out. Yeah,
that's funny. What's it like, what's the psychology of playing in a 3-piece band now?
It's definitely different, because for the first 5 or 6 years of our existence, we were a 4-piece. Our friend Paul Bowden was the other guitar player, and it was me, him, and Mark, and a parade of drummers. And eventually Paul, you know, was going steady, wanted to get married, wanted to go out to the club every night, and, you know, basically, you know, we fell apart from each other, and it was just me and Mark. And we had another guy in for 6 months. It didn't work. Let's go as a three piece. And that was like, oh, wow. Because then there's no safety net. You know, you hear everything very clearly. And it's a blessing and a curse. It's like, oh, my God, how are you going to cover this? It's like, well, it's great for me because now I can expand my tone. I can play more. I have to play more to fill the holes. The drummer has to play more to fill the holes. Guitar player, there's a lot more weight on the guitar player. But then you start listening, and wow, a lot of my favorite bands are three pieces, whether it's Emerson, Lake and Palmer or Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix or Cream or, you know, it's like, what was, and you start listening, how are they making it work? Rush, how are they making it work? How's the interplay? And a lot of things become very obvious where they're going to work or they're not. And then you're recording, okay, what are we going to do? We're going to put a rhythm guitar track down here? Well, yeah. And then live, we'll do something different. We'll, you know, change the riff and the bass will play what's underneath and we'll make it work, which we did. And it was, you know, we'd often get that compliment and say, it sounds like there was six guys up there playing. Type of nonsense, you know. And I've toured with a lot of bands where there's two guitar players and live, they're not 100% in sync. And say one guy breaks a string, all of a sudden the band sounds 20 times better. And then they fix the other guitar and comes back in, and then all of a sudden it's you know, it's bigger, but it's mushy. It's not quite there. There's very few bands I've seen with two guitar players that are that in sync. There are some. I mean, we toured with Saxon and Paul and what's his name? Rick and Doug. I mean, they're awesome. They are totally locked in. That's great because then you have that extra option where you can orchestrate and, you know, do different parts. We have to just stretch it out between the two of us with the musical instruments and then the drums to put parts in, and that way you just got to make your arrangements more interesting. So it's a challenge, but it's fun.
Well, that's really cool. I like that. And you also singing with the headset mic, that's something that we don't actually see very much. When did you pick that up?
Well, I wanted one of them from 1979. When I saw a video of Kate Bush, who's a wonderful artist and performer, and she did a lot of dance, and they made a headset for her, and it was like, oh, that would be the coolest thing ever. But I knew it was a one-off. And then 82, I think it was, we saw a video of Sammy Hagar, who was using one. It was like, oh, so this is a little closer. And we go to America for the first time and do a little research and say, okay, and then come back in 83, did a bit more research, and then 84, had the money, went and got one, went through holy hell. And it's like, why does it cut out half an hour into every show? And then Rody said, I don't know, but I realized that when I take the backpack off, I have to pour like about a cup full of sweat out of the back of it. Like, ding, yeah, that could be a problem. Yeah, there you go. So... But it's really good as far as I obviously visually I can move around, I can interact with the audience and my bandmates, and I can go for the sweet spot for something. If something sounds like really loud or annoying, I can kind of move away from it, or I can move closer to the monitor and make it sound better. And it's, you know, if it ever goes down, I always feel like someone just put a ball and chain on me. It's very annoying. So it's an important part of what I do. So I got, you know, it's like the three-ring circus. I'm acting a fool, jumping around, rabble-rousing. I'm singing. I'm moving around because I'm not stood still at a microphone. I'm playing the bass and, you know, I'm dancing around on effects every 5 minutes as well. So it's a full-time gig.
any plans for touring in the upcoming year? I mean, you were talking about a new album that you're trying to work on.
Well, that's we are going to be getting the audio to that. It's, we've got it basically together. So a few things need to be re-recorded, and we have a test mix, which is okay, but it needs just a bit more work. It's possible we're going to record one more song, because we'll probably need an extra song for an overseas extra track. But it's really exciting. It's great. We've been playing one of the songs live on the last couple of tours. And it's a song called Top of the Mountain, which gives a good indication of where we're going. It's very up-tempo, fast, a lot of parts, and extraordinarily catchy at the same time. Everyone starts singing along with it, which is fun. So there's a lot of crazy playing. Mike is out of control on the drums. It's just mental all over the place. A couple of people said, this sounds like you took Wiped Out and went back to that direction after like 30 odd years and kicked that up a notch. So that's fun. There's a, you know, and the songs are strong. I'm happy with the melodies, the vocals, the playing's great. So blah, blah, blah. It's a good one. Hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have it all put together. But we got a cool idea for the cover and all the rest of it. Just got to just put that into motion. And like I said, this live album's a great bridge between where we've been and where we're going.
I think you're going to have trouble dropping the cover for this live album. I think, other than Architect of Fear, I think this is probably your best cover.
It's definitely the best cover. And it's for a live album, especially. Covers, I hate doing covers. Covers is one of those things, is if you have a concept, everything rolls and it's great. So we had a concept for Rock Until You Drop, and it was one of the greatest covers ever. It's just, you know, stupid, us buried in our equipment, but it really told the story of what we were all about. People saw that and went, wow, I got to hear this. And then the next album, we're going to call it Wiped Out. We'll put a huge nuclear explosion on the front. A record company immediately, you can't do that. That's in poor taste. That's terrible. Here, sit in a room for 1 hour and come up with a cover or else. Oy. So hit, miss, hit, miss, hit, miss. It happens. All for One. You know, was it based on the song's based on a show about D'Artagnan and the Three Musketeers. There you go. There's the cover. Some things come very easy. Other times, you know, it's tough. On this one, we basically had the cover idea. I mean, it came from a T-shirt we did for the tour. And we were talking to our record company guy, and he says, well, we got the cover. He goes, really? He goes, yeah, it's the shirt. I'm like, duh, yeah. So we actually had the shirt for the album before we even had the album. So there you go.
That's funny.
Brilliant.
How about your logo, actually? Because I think that's, you know, I mean, you've had it for years. And I always thought it was, like, one of the coolest logos in you know, kind of.
That's me. I drew that.
You're kidding. Oh, nice.
Nope. I came up with that. It was we had it as gothic writing. It was actually a wooden panel from my piano that came with it. Had it painted on it. There's a couple of old photos of that hanging up. Our old drummer Rob at one point had some crazy logo which looked like birds' wings, which were the R and then dipped down into the V and came back, which looked kind of ugly. He had that for about 6 months. And then we were going to do the album, and I was looking around and seeing, you know, these angular logos like the newer, the Priest one and Iron Maiden and all this. And I thought, I think Raven is pointy. There's not many curves in the letters in Raven. Let's see what I can come up with. And did that. And I've been fighting with people to put the flash on ever since.
Ah, yeah.
There's always some art director that misses it off. Oh, you wanted that? No. It's an integral part of it, you idiot. Yeah. And it still happens. To this day, it still happens. So there you go.
Yeah, because the logo is so important in just the branding of the band and making sure that, because the second that you see that, even just like part of that, you know that it's Raven.
Yeah, it's part and parcel of what you are about. I mean, it's clean, it's pointy, it looks energetic. The flash is a little spark of energy or electricity. So, yeah, you know, it's a large part. I never understood bands that had maybe a good logo and then just decided to change it every album.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand you want to try and change up what you're doing every time, but you do want to keep an identity, and that's one of the things that's going to keep your identity is having an identifiable logo. So yeah, we're very lucky in that worked out great, and we do have that.
All right. We're hoping that you're going to find time to come over to Calgary next tour, because I see you're
hopefully the plan. We've never broached, the Great White Central, as it were. We've never been to Calgary. We've never been to Edmonton. We got as far as Des Moines on the last tour, and that was freaking unloading in 10 below. That was not fun, let me tell you. Hell no.
10 below, we were short.
Yeah,
exactly. That's like what they say about people here in Newcastle, where it's like, 20 below, and they go out to the club in T-shirts, I'm not one of those people from here. I'm dressed up like an Eskimo 90% of the time, so the hell with that. All right, where were we? We were talking about Edmonton and Calgary. So, yes, hopefully this, worth looking at doing this possible tour with a bunch of new wave of British heavy metal bands, which will be fun, some old friends of ours, and if it comes off. And we've said we'd love to come out to, Calgary, Edmonton, places we've never played before. Should be an awful lot of fun. So, fingers crossed on that. Other than that, we are off to Japan in March. I've just literally yesterday been contacted by someone who wants us to play China right after it.
Wow.
Which is fun. We've got a couple of festivals in Europe in June and July, and this upcoming tour, and we are looking to do probably another opening slot in Europe later in the year too. So keep us busy. Keep us out of trouble.
if you come up here to Canada, then we think we have good beer, but it might not meet your standards, I'm afraid.
you'll have to test me, brother. I'm easy pleased with beer. I'll look at it and go, yeah, it's beer. Yeah, wonderful.
It's better than most of what you get in America, I think, personally. But you probably had worse.
Yeah, that's the old joke about American beer is like making love in a canoe. Can I say that on the air?
Yes, you can.
Say it. Go for it. We know it. It's good.
All right. It's fucking close to water.
That's right.
There you go.
I love it. That's great. All right. Well, and you guys, I'm curious, actually, one last thing here. No, New Year's Eve, historically, is that a good night to play a gig? Is that is there a lot of people out there? Or is it terrible?
Terrible night. I don't think we've ever done that. We've occasionally played on Halloween, which can be fun. It can be all right. But New Year, no. That's totally drunksville and makes no sense. Makes no sense. No good. We'll steer well clear of that.
Always busy.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I hope you have an excellent New Year's Eve, whatever your plans are then, still.
Thank you so much. Same to you, Rod. And to the people out there, have a wonderful New Year. And we hope to see you in some shape, form, or function during it.
Well, we hope that the 2019 for Raven is amazing, and that all the rest of the years for Raven, because I mean, you've been going for a long time, and I hope you're able to go for another 45. Keep on playing.
We're having so much fun. We're playing, the best we've ever played, and just a lot of things are happening over like the last year, 18 months. It's crazy. So, all good. Where, we've been around the block so many times, you feel it when momentum is picking up and starting, and it's a good feeling. So we're getting our surfboards out, and we're going to ride that wave. Make it happen.
Awesome. Well, John Gallagher, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. We've had a great time. You're a really engaging guest, and we look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Bye!
Awesome. Thank you so much, John.
Cheers, man. Take care.
All right. Bye now.